Hello, everyone. I'm Lou Marciani, the director of the Innovation Institute for Fan Experience. Welcome to today's town hall, the future of policing in the sports and entertainment industry. The mission of IIF Institute is to serve as the leading and most trusted global authority on providing exceptional fan experience for sports and entertainment. Nothing is more important than safety and security in assuring an exceptional fan experience throughout their game day journey. Our distinguished panel members are on the front lines of every pressing security challenge in the sports and entertainment industry. As we look back, the events of 9/11 created a new safety and security dynamics in our industry. Since then, several milestones have occurred that have affected the role of policing. To mention a few, such as COVID pandemic resulting in workforce issues and society changes. We are currently experiencing public debates on the role of policing in the wake of George Floyd's tragic death in 2020 have brought policing front and center. Thus the reason for this important town hall. Those in the audience will have an opportunity to pose questions to the distinguished panels who will draw upon their expertise to help create the and look at the security environment of today and the future. I want to thank the members of the expert panels and those of you attending today's town hall. I would like to introduce Gary Garner, IIF Distinguished Fellow, who will serve as today's moderator. So Gary, it's all yours.
Thank you, Lou. We pulled together, as Lou said, a distinguished group of experts that cover a broad spectrum of sports and entertainment throughout the world. And so I'd like to start by introducing Rick Fenton, who's the Vice President and Chief Security Officer of Illich Holdings and an IIFX Distinguished Fellow. He's been with Illich Holdings since 2000, and he oversees and directs all corporate security, safety functions, venue security and safety, security systems, corporate loss prevention and investigations, and the executive services across the Illich companies, which includes the Little Caesars Arena, Comerica Park, the Red Wings, Pistons, and the Tigers. Also with us is Jim Mercurio, also an IIFX Distinguished Fellow and former Executive Vice President and General Manager of Levi's Stadium, home to the San Francisco 49ers. Jim spent more than 30 years with the 49ers, overseeing all aspects of stadium and event operations. Also with us is Eileen Williams, a senior safety officer for the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium and Football Club in London. She is also an IIFX Distinguished Fellow. And for more than 20 years, Eileen has worked in the event industry and specializes in safety, security, and service delivery at major sporting events and music festivals. Lieutenant Amy Horwitz is a 20-year veteran of the San Francisco Police Department. She's worked a variety of assignments during her career, including district station patrol, plainclothes investigations, municipal transit unit, and counterterrorism. Lieutenant Horwitz currently works in the Homeland Security Unit and has responsibilities as the officer in charge of the SFPD Marine Unit and the officer in charge of police services for Chase Center, home of the Golden State Warriors. Joe Monroe, the chief of police for the University of Kentucky. Joe began his tenure as chief of police in 2009 and oversees 191 employees and an $11 million annual budget. He oversees the operations of the police, security for the UK healthcare facilities, campus security technology, and several other units. So welcome to my panelists. We'll start off with the first question, Amy. Most law enforcement contacts that officers run into at these events are certainly of a lesser degree or nature, but all too often, they escalate into something that can tarnish the brand or bring a negative light on the organization. And almost all law enforcement will say that they're not there to enforce policy. But all too frequently, when staff are enforcing policy, that elevates into a situation that requires the law enforcement officers to assist in these situations. So how do you see that, particularly in an age when we have less law enforcement available to work these events? How do you address that out in San Francisco?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. I think that this is a wonderful organization, and I really support the work that you do. So it's an interesting question and a long question. So, you know, there's a few different components that you gave us. So first of all, yes, policing is different than it was. We are, you know, going through a period of reform for the better. And there are fewer police. There are certainly fewer police in San Francisco. But sort of the way that we work this to our advantage and to everybody's, you know, safety advantage is really forming a partnership with, in my example, it's going to be the Chase Center and Chase Center security and Chase Center staff. So really everyone in that arena is responsible security, from the vendors to the security people, the ushers, and certainly us. The officers that I have working at the Chase Center understand that they are part of the fan experience. So it's a high ticket price that people are paying, and I want our officers to reflect the quality and the value that they're getting in that. We don't want to enforce stadium or arena policy, but we are certainly there to support it when things aren't going as planned. So if you have somebody who's not going with the program, that is when, you know, it's our turn to help that situation, you know, go the way everybody wants it to go. And, you know, really at the core of this is the partnership with the arena and everybody understanding that, you know, our visibility and our working together eliminates a lot of problems that we have.
Very good. Yes. And Jim, how can venue security and law enforcement better interface in an incident? And should law enforcement have post orders for events?
Hey, Gary, good morning. Good afternoon. I guess wherever you are. Well, first of all, let me back up and talk with Amy for a second to suggest I'm a little bit biased. It's okay. But your officers are some of the best in the business. And for over 30 years, I've had the experience of dealing with that. But so you really shouldn't have any worry there, given the fact and the track record that I think the San Francisco Police Department has. With respect to incidents, Gary, and how they handle them and how they should interface, I think first it needs the collaboration and the communication with each other literally far prior to any incident. And what I mean by that is it's important for operators, venue operators, police, fire, security, all of those folks to, in a sense, break bread prior to even working an event, in my opinion. And what I mean by that is it's important to that they know each other for the very fact that upon coming on an incident, it's not a business card kind of exchange. You already have a trust factor. You have an understanding of what's expected in the venue. You have an understanding of who you're working with, whether it's an officer, a sergeant, or a lieutenant that's, you know, coming to the incident. So I would really press your folks that are on the call and people that are in the business to do everything you can to better engage with law enforcement the days and weeks and months and years prior to even opening up your venue for the year or any event that you might have. In terms of whether or not somebody should have or police officers should have post orders, I absolutely believe in that. I believe there should be certain assignments to those officers, but they can't be so restrictive to the fact that they can't go respond to other areas within the incident, within the stadium, for example, or the parking lot or wherever you have them assigned. But it's equally as important to be able to understand what is expected of the law enforcement personnel as it is what I believe to be in a step-up approach of guest services and security supervisors and alike. To have certain responsibilities over enforcing policy. In many cases, police officers are going to suggest, hey, you know, we're here really to kind of keep the peace and protect against bigger things like terrorism attacks and things of that nature, right? At the same time, they have to be a face not only for their organization, but ours. And so there are going to be times where you're going to be asked to approach somebody that's, you know, breaking policy with the no smoking ordinance or some other issue that if they see it, they should act on it, not just defer that to somebody else. So that partnership and that collaboration needs to happen, but there does need to be a separation of church and state, so to speak.
And Eileen or Rick, do you have any comments regarding that?
I'll jump in, Eileen. I think Jim touched on something that's really critically important is, yes, we do have post orders, but you can't start the relationship a half an hour before the event starts. So our seasons begin with a lot of planning. We'll meet with the police department, for example, from a hockey and basketball perspective in early September. I think Amy would agree that we do use some post orders for those police officers around the basketball court, an entirely different setup than obviously a hockey game where the court is exposed to the folks. But in a hockey game, you've got boards and glass separating separating the crowd from the actual playing surface. I think it's also different in terms of what we're asking police officers to do now. So we got a lot of things that are coming into play, and I think you would agree with this, Jim, from a league's perspective. So when I first started, we weren't screening guests. Now we actually have police support at all of our guest screening areas. And the reality is we're still recovering firearms and things and folks that are illegally trying to carry it either in the city. And that necessitates, a police action. And it wouldn't normally have been getting arrested walking around in the city of Detroit, Amy, unless they happen to come across one of our venues. And now they're trying to walk in. They set off a metal detector, and we've got a law enforcement action. So it's a little bit different than it was when I first started 23 years ago.
And here in London, we don't have a gun crime culture, and therefore it would be highly unlikely for anybody to present at the stadium with a firearm. Roles, just to reinforce the roles, the relationship, the dedicated roles and responsibilities. We also, from a football perspective, will have our planning meetings for the season in June once our fixtures are out. And we have dedicated, I insist on having the same police commanders come and work with us so we can build that relationship year on year and that we have that trust. Here we also have a very standard delivery of training for stewards, ushers and security operatives, which allows us to have a national program of stewarding that, again, fits into the role and responsibility. Therefore, with good training, good risk assessments, it very rarely would we have police officers inside a stadium in the UK, but they will help us. I mean, for example, we've got an event this evening. They will help and assist on the ingress and potentially looking at any disorder that is associated with soccer here. But I think we're okay tonight. So, but roles, responsibilities, good training, good risk assessments, and looking at where best to put the mitigation. So it may be law enforcement, it may be stewarding, just depending on the audience profile, et cetera.
And on that point, Eileen, could you briefly explain a little bit about the stewards? Because we don't generally have that position here in the United States.
Okay. So a steward is a paid member of staff that works for us, looking at customer service, safety, security and service. So potentially where you have somebody coming in, they will do all the search and screen. They will do the ticket checking. They will do the mandatory positions of looking at our emergency exits, for example. They will also resolve any issues within the stadium. So if we have a hate crime or some disorder or medical, then the stewards are the people who respond to try and dissolve or de-escalate and resolve an issue on point. They're all paid. We don't have any volunteers. Some of our venues here do have volunteers that work. So at Twickenham, and which is a rugby venue, and Lords, which is a cricket venue, they do have some honorary stewards who are volunteers who love it. But at our venue, we have 45 major events per year, including concerts, rugby, NFL, and soccer. And so we rely on a paid workforce that is trained to a national standard of stewarding. So we know what we're getting when we book and employ staff at the venue.
You know, kind of pivoting on from that, Rick, you're kind of taking somewhat of a unique approach here with your security officers and their ability to have police authority. And you're looking at getting them that authority through the local sheriff, correct?
Correct. So what I would say, and I think Amy touched on it, we have far fewer police officers in the city of Detroit than we did 10, 15 years ago. When I was assigned to the Detroit Police Department in the early 70s, which means I'm really old, Amy, the reality is we had about 5,000 officers, and now there's less than 2,500. When I was a member of the Sheriff's Department, we had nearly 2,000 officers. They have less than 1,000. So with four major sports teams playing in the downtown area, there just isn't enough law enforcement officers to go around to have events going on at all of those locations at the same time. And bluntly, we're actually challenged when two of the locations are in play. So we've worked with the Lowe's Sheriff. We've got a starter program that we went through with about 18 of my staff that are former law enforcement officers. They're sworn in. But we're looking at expanding that into a reserve element with the same kinds of police powers and things. And then they would be supervised by the Detroit Police Department and the Sheriff's Department. So it's an interesting concept. It's one where we're using the constitutional office of the sheriff to swear people in. And we'll see how that goes. There's a lot of things, a lot of moving pieces to get it off the ground.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, if you don't mind. They're all in the same uniform, or are they in separate uniforms as your...
It's a great question, Jeff.
Yeah.
Distinguish a sheriff reserve from a sheriff, a formal sheriff deputy, between a light colored pants and a dark shirt for the regular deputies, and an all dark brown uniform for the reserves. And what's interesting is, as you know, Jim, we have a couple amphitheaters, and those are in two other counties. And the local PDs do not provide services there. The sheriff's departments do. And we use a combination of reserve officers and sheriff deputies for those venues as well. So we're sort of taking that concept and then bringing it downtown to see if we can get it off the ground here.
Yeah, the only difference is in Santa Clara, when we opened up Levi Stadium, for that same reason, Santa Clara PD was a small, is a small agency. And so we were able to create what's called the double badge program, and of which San Francisco and certain San Francisco sheriff actually participates. The only difference is that they are deputized and wore Santa Clara uniforms. So you had no difference in terms of the appearance, which, you know, gave us the comfort level that, you know, everybody there has the same authority and there was no differential. And then the other piece was, hey, is this uniform coming into our building, you know, one of ours, or is there a couple different uniforms, and, you know, somebody wearing a different uniform could pose a little bit different of a threat to those that might not check. But it was very successful for us for all the years that we did it down in Santa Clara, and they're continuing to do that today. So I wish you the continued success there.
It's interesting with the different uniforms, Jim. It's really a great point.
You might want to think about that.
If Eddie Washington was on the call, he'd talk about Michigan Stadium. There's five different law enforcement agencies,
right,
and five different sets of uniforms. And Joe just popped on, so I'm sure Joe can share some thoughts on that.
Yeah, you're exactly right on that. Because we probably have 200 plus officers and probably about 10 different agencies. So, I mean, trying to put them on one uniform would be hard for us. But what we try to do is recognize all of them at our roll calls and making sure that we know that they are working for us that day, because we're bringing
in all. What about the radio system, Joe? Are they on the same radio system? Yeah.
So what we do, Jim, is we actually give them a radio if they're not part of the regional radio system. And that way we have complete interoperability and can all be on the same frequency and talk groups.
Which is important for sure. Yeah.
No, that's clearly important. And Joe, that kind of leads into the next point. And before I start that, I meant to mention early on that a lot of the questions we're using today were submitted by attendees on this call, where they have a particular interest and they lead into the future of policing and how we're having to address things today. So Joe, to what extent should law enforcement be involved in that initial planning in a lead up to the event? And then, can police keep an event from taking place if they have concerns about the plans?
Well, let's talk about the planning piece first, because that is probably the most critical component. You cannot draft a event action plan unless you have law enforcement and your public safety team involved in that process. You know, they have to go through that risk analysis to make sure they understand what their risk or hazards are, and then what resources they're going to need to staff that. And one of the things that you'll find is too many times we operate in silos, whether it's on the event side or whether it's on public safety side. But we've got to get to that point where we have a good planning team. And you'll see that a lot with regular events, whether, you know, it's Jim's stuff that he's doing out there or Rick. You know, we have that core group that we always plan with, and that helps a lot. But you've got to have them involved in the planning process. Now, as far as can they stop an event? I'm going to say no, unless there's some critical component that really drafts it, you know, a necessity. One of the things that law enforcement can do is they can make recommendations and to your event planner or your promoter, and which we've done on numerous occasions, whether it's a concert or another special event. Hey, here's what we need to think about, because this is really putting us at risk if we're not going to elevate our staffing or our mitigation strategies to that level.
Eileen, there are specific features of an entertainment district that create problems and demands for police resources. And I know you have some unique challenges in that area. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Being we're predominantly a football stadium, a soccer stadium, but our stadium is actually located right in the center of a residential area. So we have literally 20 feet and we're hitting houses around our venue, and to that, looking at working with business as usual. So again, there's another customer relation there with our residential population. We've got about 66,000 people, homes which are affected by our events when we have an event here. So we've got one this evening, we'll have 66,000 people coming, but effectively they're walking past another 66,000 people who are located in the area, affected by transport, affected by people using the facilities, the shops, etc. And notwithstanding, then there's a piece where we want to look at looking after our neighbours around antisocial behaviour, depending on whether we win or we don't win this evening. There might be some noise going on the way home. And certainly with the venue itself, billed as a 365 entertainment venue, the audience profiles that come here again challenge us. So we've had boxing matches, which again do give us a huge amount of antisocial behaviour post-event. And so going back to the planning with the police, here in the UK, every event is planned by the safety teams and people like myself. And we own the venue, we own the event. And by risk assessment, then we would work with the police here to say, do we need police officers in the stadium? Do we need them externally? Do we need them at that post-match phase of the event? So it's a very much a working relationship with them. In terms of the complex nature of a residential area with a complete public transport venue, again, we have a transport police system here as well, so we work very much with those. The challenge in London is we have 25 venues. If we go forward to the 3rd of June, for example, we have the FA Cup final for soccer. We have Beyonce on. Well, that's already up to 150,000 people going within 6 mile radius of the venue of London. The London Stadium is hosting another 60,000 event with another music event concert. So then we start to look at policing and their ability to supply into all of those major events. In a couple of weeks' time, we have the coronation of the King. Again, there's a whole football and sports programme on over the weekend. So they have to really work with us to look at the risk assessment to ensure that they've got the resources to do that. So yeah, it is complex, and we do compete for resources with another 25 venues in a busy capital.
And you kind of have a lot of that here in Detroit, Rick, where you have three sports venues within about three blocks of each other, as well as other entertainment, theaters, opera, and casinos in the neighborhood, yes?
So if Gary was being brutally honest, we're literally sitting in the conference room at the Fock Building. And the Fock Building actually holds a theater with about 5,000 people. I'm looking out the conference room window. We're watching the load-in getting ready for our Tiger baseball game tonight and closing down roads. We can look across the back of the stadium and see Ford Field. And we're hoping we get a couple of really great draft choices tonight, Jimmy. And then over my left shoulder is actually the hockey arena and basketball arena. So the reality is we're the only U.S. city with all four professional sports teams literally within three blocks of one another. So it's a major cluster of activity between concert, sporting events, and other entertainment events that we host at the Fox Theater and the theater next door to us.
And in fact, we just went through a major exercise up here yesterday where there was actually events ongoing simulated in all three of those venues. And it went very well. But I think that's an important aspect going back to what Jim and Amy said about, you know, coordination and training and exercising so that everybody knows their roles on game day.
Gary, I think one thing that to touch on as well as what Eileen brought up was the fact that we got to look at our neighborhoods, your surrounding neighborhood and businesses, because they are part of that planning process. And many times we forget about that, whether it's neighborhood associations or your businesses, your bars, like Rick has up there. I mean, all those different type of things need to be included in that process.
Yeah, I'm looking out a window and I've got two schools in front of me. On the other side, I've got a church. So we have a Sunday event. We've got to have the development, the relationship with the church and the their timings for worship, etc. So it's really important when you've got a demanding venue that's pushing out that neighbourhood is so important to us, because they'll make or break you. And from our perspective, they have a committee. They work with our local authority who can insist that, you know, can affect the number of events we might have here, because if there's an adverse effect to them that which is unpleasant, they don't want to have events here because it's affecting their way of life and their living.
You know, that highlights the point where we're talking about the future and the lack of resources. It's more important to collaborate with each other, get buy-in from the community. Amy, what are the biggest vulnerabilities or security threats to sporting venues that you think are present today in society?
There's many that we could look at. I mean, if you want to take it from the broader sense of, you know, terrorist targets, and these are what we would call soft targets because they can't get up and run away. You have a large amount of people in a small area. You have a lot of people queued up. I use that word queued for you, Eileen. You have a lot of people lined up. So, you know, and they're not going anywhere. So if you take it from the homeland security sense, and, you know, you're incorporating terrorists and counterterrorism into the way you're thinking, stadiums are a prime target. You know, if you're talking about basic fan safety or issues that come up, you know, and caring for our fans, then I think that we need to address the issue of alcohol use and how that is affecting the people that are coming into our neighborhoods and into our arenas. So we definitely have different challenges, you know, that run the gamut from something as simple as, you know, alcohol use to terrorist acts. And, you know, when your people are walking out into the neighborhoods, what are they then, you know, faced with? What is your crime rate around your arenas? What is happening to their vehicles? What about the public transit thing? So that's a very broad question that you asked. And it just means that we really have to pay attention to everything.
A specific thing for here in the UK at the moment is protesting groups. Just Stop Oil, the snooker world championships, they got into the arena and they threw orange paint all over the snooker tables to disrupt. We've had them here at the stadium where they've tried to latch themselves onto our goals with cable ties. and disrupt. And so that protesting groups, particularly those that are around environmental issues and animal rights. We had a horse meet a couple of weeks ago at the Grand National, and again, 160 protesters tried to get in because of animal rights. So there are very emotive things that people are not necessarily sinister, but certainly cause you issues or give you safeguarding issues around even their own protection of the protesters, because people got very fed up with them. Bit of dissent in the ranks over here in terms of strikes and so on as well. But that that protesting group is something that we're permanently tracking.
And I think we're confronting that here too, Eileen, in a lot of different fronts because of social issues, political issues, you know, and those things can almost be spontaneous today. Anybody else?
I will jump in because we are a city that is known for our First Amendment freedoms. One of the mandates of our department is, you know, our first priority is to protect First Amendment rights. So at our NBA playoffs last year, we were confronted with this issue. We had, you know, various groups outside of the arena protesting. They made it inside, only two people, and it was a very temporary thing that, it was addressed immediately and it caused no disturbance. And I think that's because we had some intel on the front end, knowing that this was a possibility. So I think, you know, it's, you have to sort of mind the chatter on your social networks. And, you know, there are companies that will do that. We have people that will do it. There's government agencies that'll do it, but that really helps you, understand what is coming your way.
Gary, there's a perfect collaboration there between the police department and the Chase Center and all of the agencies involved in that operation. Having that commitment early on is going to help you upon that incident, which is a perfect example of it.
Yeah, I think Amy hit on the importance of intelligence gathering. We actually have a formal MOU with our fusion centers, with the Detroit Police Department. We had a known protest that we were able to identify through social media when we were opening the arena, where we had a number of groups wanted to come down and protest Kid Rock. And the reality is through intelligence gathering, social media monitoring. To your point, Amy, we knew about it in advance. We could plan with our law enforcement stakeholders of how we wanted to handle that. And then we actually went out and spoke with the groups ahead of time. They were able to do what they wanted to do because we want to respect those First Amendment rights. And we were able to do 6 sold out Kid Rock shows. So it was a win-win for everyone.
Okay. And kind of pivoting into some of the future aspects, if you will. And I'm just going to throw this out to everybody. What's kind of on your horizon when you look out? Where do you see the sports and entertainment industry going, say, in the next 5 years? And then I'm going to follow that up with what changes do you see coming in that 5 to 10 year period that is specifically related to security at our events? So first, what do you all kind of see coming in the next 5 years that may really change some of the dynamics of our events?
Gary, I think one of the things that we're going to see more and more of is more technology playing into this role, whether it's mobile credentialing, mobile parking, mobile ticketing, all these different things, you know, facial recognition. There's a lot of places now that are using facial recognition for the ticket. So I think a lot of that is coming. And we're right on the edge of it. And I think it's about ready to explode into our industry.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, one of the things coming out of COVID was the lack of paper tickets anymore. I mean, there's almost no events that have paper tickets these days.
Well, and you're seeing a lot of evolution on how we do guest screening. And so we were really dependent on walk-through metal detectors. I don't want to talk about any particular name brand, but when you start looking at what Evolve is trying to do, Patriot trying to do, Chea opening, these are all new evolutions in how you can detect firearms and other weapons. It's certainly making it a faster process. I hope it's actually making it a more reliable process. I'm not so sure. I think the story is out on that. But those things are going to continue. And then to Joe's point, I think facial ticketing and all those kinds of things. We're there right now, Joe, and we're expanding on that all the time. Once again, it's a guest experience kind of a thing, but it's actually helping. It's getting people into the venues faster and more seamlessly.
Yeah, I kind of see it a couple different ways. One, recognition versus authentication, which is, I think, is the term that a little bit people are trying to move towards, especially for our friends out here in San Francisco. But it also, it does mean something a little bit different. So I do think that's important, and I see that going there. The other piece is, I think for years we've had very segmented, siloed kind of departments, right? Part, you are a parking person, usher, you are a security guard, you're a food beverage, you're a guest services person. I think what's going to have to happen because of the lack of initiative in many cases of people that want to be employed, you're going to have to consolidate some of these and do a better job of redeploying your personnel and maybe paying them a little bit more, but getting and giving them more training. Maybe the model is of a steward. We have stewards, so to speak, Gary. We just call them ushers, or we call them ticket takers, or we call them all these different things, right? So I think a more cross-pollinated, kind of well-rounded, developed employee who might work in the parking lot for a few hours, but then at the gate for a few hours, and then as a usher for a few hours, and then back in the parking lot for a few hours, to give them a full 8-hour day, but trained in more than just one or two items or disciplines is where I see venues and venue operators looking to lean towards, to be one of two things: more effective and efficient with their employees and the costs associated with them, but also the level of service and a better level of training that perhaps you can provide. And third, you might see agencies or teams taking a little bit more ownership of the training associated with those employees. For years, we outsourced it to the food and beverage provider, to the security provider, to the parking provider. And then you put in a few of the team or the venue's ideologies and the pillars of excellence that we want included in that training. It might behoove us to take a little bit more of an approach and owning that training of all of the different 15 to 3,000 people that work for you on game day, because they're promoting and representing your brand and your team and your venue and your ownership and your city. And most of these folks are part-time people that feel part-time. And so anything you can do as a venue manager and operator to make them feel not like a part-time employee, but a full-time employee and part of your team and family, I think is going to be important. So I'd love to see the industry take a little bit more of a ownership in that in the next years.
We're just doing some work at the moment looking at what a steward of 2030 would look like. Okay, so that 12-year-old today and their techno world that they're coming through. So in 7 years, when I expect them to be working for me, what technological advancements will take place? There'll be jobs, doing jobs we haven't even thought of just now. So we're kind of looking at the current recruitment strategy has to move with TikTok and other engagement tools to look at getting the best people into our business and then keeping them. And how do we engage with them? Because they only work for us when we have an event on. So we're just doing some work around what is the trigger for young people coming into potentially the industry, looking at resume writing with them so that they can use the skill set they've got within this particular piece of work of security operatives, et cetera, and where they can use that in other industries so that they can have a good resume that says, well, I know about health and safety, I know how to de-escalate conflict, and I can take my qualification and use it in other industries. So I can use it in the retail, I can use it at university if I want to. So we're looking at how we do that. And but I think it's important to think, what are those young people? I mean, the majority of people we have applying for jobs with us are 19 to 26. And they are super whiz kids on technology, social media. I am not. And I'm having to learn about that that younger workforce and how their brains work. But equally, you can apply that then to our guests. Our guests are also, you know, there's an element of in the next 10 years, some of our season card holders will be no longer with us. And that young person is coming back through us as a guest. So in terms of policing and understanding how we look at the psychology of what's coming through, of how they think, how they view the world, this instant, we want stuff instantly because of the feeding of social media. So we're just doing some work with that at the moment to look at the next 7 years of recruitment, both for our customers and both and our staffing. And I think those are the kinds of things that we should be considering for the, you know, it's only 7 years away, for goodness sake. It's not a long time to 2030. And it'll be, you know, it's quite frightening because it's frightening for me because I'm not a technical person. I like people. And so I'm on a huge learning journey myself to understand how I can better be safer, use the technology to enhance our operation, to not worry so much about the numbers of workforce that we need, whether it be police officers and or ushers or car park attendants. But, you know, it's a huge learning journey for me at the age I'm at and not being a technical specialist. I'm learning, though. I'm learning.
Well, and how technology is going to pivot to play a big role in how we train these people, because they relate to these things that, as you say, Eileen, we don't necessarily relate to so much, but they live on them.
Hmm.
And so we're used to pulling people into classrooms for training. They're used to getting their training online.
And there's some really good research coming through now about the dopamine hits that people get when their social media pings on their phone. And it's very addictive. So you know, very rarely can anybody hear something go off on their phone and ignore it. And therefore, again, understanding the triggers for people that are working where you don't want them to have a customer complaining because a member of staff is on their phone the whole time. Yeah, there's a really good couple of papers that I've been looking at recently that say the impact of social media. A goldfish can retain information for about 12 seconds, a psychologist told me. And now young people, we're at the ability of retaining stuff for about 14 seconds. Might be my age, I'm not sure. But it's a new age. It's something we need to be considering because that's our next group of customers and our next group of workforce and police officers.
You must see a lot of that, Joe, on a college campus.
Yeah, I was going to say it goes back to Jim's whole premise to start this conversation, engagement. That's the key word. It's staff engagement. It's fan engagement. I mean, that's where it all starts. And, you know, like Eileen was saying, you're dealing with a generation now that is technology savvy. When a two-year-old can get on a cell phone and take pictures of himself and send it, I mean, you know, that's stuff that we never even thought of at 2 years older when we had two-year-olds. I mean, but, you know, I think that's the key to everything is finding that niche or that technology that's going to keep them engaged, whether it's a fan or whether it's a staff employee. That's the, I think, the way we're headed.
Like Gary, if I can wrap it.
Please.
If I can wrap it up here, I think where we have, at least I have been successful, my teams have been successful, has been paying attention to the needs of the employee as if they were a customer, right? We've spent so much time and effort trying to understand our customer, even investing in it and target marketing to our customer. And for years have kind of forgot about the employee. Oh, they're going to show up. They're going to be here. They're going to do this. Oh, we don't need to. Let's put the customer right up front to the parking lot. Let's put the employee on a bus and two blocks away. And I kind of tried to put that on its heels a little bit and upend that cart to suggest that the employee, in many cases, is equally, if not more important than your customer, right? Because these are the people that are representing you and reaching out to your customer. So I think it's healthy to look at your customer and your employee as an internal customer as opposed to an external customer and try to do and incentivize those things with good behavior. Again, that makes them feel as if they're part of your team, makes them feel as they're part of your family, and little things matter. So anytime that the suit and tie can get out of the office and walk the concourse, and engage with the employee, you should do it. You should know as many of the folks and your supervisors as you can. You're not going to know all 3,000 people, but sitting behind your desk isn't going to help make me feel special about making $50 or $100 that day in your venue. Neither is having to park five blocks away, get on two buses, stay till the end, and not be a treat, feel like I'm cared for or treated well. So to folks listening, I would say invest in your employees, and they'll invest in you. And the dividends will outweigh any expenses associated with that. I believe that to the core.
Rick? Well, I agree with everything that Jim said. And I think what COVID taught us, we were primarily an internal workforce, used very, very few vendors before COVID hit. We lost a large segment of our event-based population after the issues with COVID, because a lot of them were retirees. And quite frankly, they didn't want to be around large groups of folks.
Yeah.
And so then we started, the pendulum went a different direction, Jim, and we started investing in different vendor to provide security, to provide stuff from a concessions and a retail perspective. And we're having to relearn that. And it's only probably been within the last 6 months.
Right.
Remarkably so, that we're starting to see the trend turn around. Maybe it's some downturn in the Michigan economy.
Sure. But I'm sure
going back out, and looking for that second job. So then we're trying to do what Joe suggested. You're trying to make that investment in these folks. And we're doing things that we never did before to try to attract them.
We're just on a journey of we regularly need internally 1,000 and 1,200 stewards. And we had seven agencies supporting us in that when we opened our stadium 4 years ago. And this time last year, we had about 150 internal stewards. Now we have 690 internal stewards. And very much, again, along the line of Jim is saying, we look after them. Everybody has a hot meal on arrival. They're all in the same uniform. We communicate with them regularly. We give them feedback on, you kick somebody out, but we've managed to process them through the court system or whatever. And it's really finding that niche that makes you the employer of choice. You know, why do they want to come and work for us and they don't want to work for an agency? If an agency, they could have work in all four venues, all 24 or five venues, but they seem to want to come and work with us because we're humans. We treat them properly. We like to get to know their names and working my way through that. Like Jim, you don't ever walk past the concourse without saying hello to the stewards. But this is a change in most of the direction for the UK, because the majority of our associates in other venues are going from internal to agency. So we're kind of reversing that trend at the moment.
We've had a question come in from our attendees out there. Could we address the issues surrounding court or field intrusions? And there seems to be more and more of this happening today. And some of it, I think, driven by social media, because they get these hits, if they're out there doing these things. Amy, you want to lead off? Do you see more of that out there that you're addressing?
You know, knock on wood, we have been fairly lucky with that at the Chase Center. However, again, it's the intelligence that is gathered prior to the game has been fairly significant in helping us, sort of stave that off or be cognizant of it. There are definitely policies in place on how that will be handled. We meet before every event, and we talk about, what will happen in the event of, court intrusion, stage intrusion, back of house intrusions, things like that. So we're ready for it. And maybe that makes us less of a viable, let's say, target for people who are thinking of doing it. But I am definitely aware that it's happening. And I think probably the best way to handle that is just to be ready for it, just to anticipate that it will happen.
Gary, as this is one of my pet peeves. And Don, it's good to hear from Donald. I haven't seen him for years, but I think it is a huge issue that needs to be mitigated, not only at the PD level, but at the district attorney's level. And so what I'm suggesting that is that leagues and police departments and the DA get together to understand the importance of this, the safety importance of it for our athletes, but for even those that are enticed to jump on the court or the field. That's one of the issues that's got me to thinking about policing in a different way, because the police officers who are doing the job and sending people to jail or to the DA to prosecute with much greater things than trespassing on a court are not even being prosecuted. So the police officer is doing their job. Then it gets sent to the DA. And what do you think the police officers feel like when the DA says, I don't have time for that because I got more important cases to file? Well, that just allows for a number of things to happen. The police officer says, forget it. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm not going to waste my time and write up this incident. The person that keeps jumping down on the court on the field says, look, Mom, I got on national TV and all it cost me was $25. If that, I didn't go to jail and there's no consequence. And so when there's no consequence, the behavior becomes something that is essentially implicitly accepted, right? So those are the concerns that I have. And I would get that conversation. I would like to get that national conversation happening with DAs across the country. Eileen, I know you might have something on this.
In 1989, obviously there's a lot of football violence and disorder going on, hooliganism, and that introduced the Spectator Safety Act directly relating to soccer, which made it an illegal offence. So it is a criminal offence to go on the field of play for football, only football. So when we have the NFL and somebody goes on the pitch, it's kind of trespass, but unless it's anything aggravated or criminal against the player or a match official, then there's not much we can do apart from kick somebody out and try and remove them from the stadium and give them a ban. But it's for football, it's very effective. A football banning order can be issued by our courts, which means it stops anybody from England and Wales actually travelling with the national team, travelling outside of the UK. They have to have their passports in. So it's quite a comprehensive and robust consequence to that. You also lose your season card, you're not allowed to go to any football and so forth. So but that's been established now since 1990 and implemented and well and a really robust process. And of course it's a political will to do some of these things. And it's tough when we have another type of event where somebody encroaches on the field and have to go, gotta kick this person out and I can't do anything else with it. So It's that's hard.
So, Gary, I think, first of all, we got to step back and look. Are these the onesie-twosie intrusions that, you know, somebody's running out on the field to get or the court to get some kind of recognition? Or we had one student do it this year who did it on a dare to make $500 from his buddies. But, you know, then you've got the true field encroachments, you know, the Alabama loss to Tennessee where you have – 60,000-80,000 people on a field, that becomes dangerous. And that's when people get hurt coming over the walls or getting crushed, like, you know, Eileen had, back in several years ago in Europe. And one of the things we got to focus on, to Jim's point, is these ADs have got to quit, or these, directors or presidents have to quit writing checks and saying it's part of doing business. Because too many times that's what we're seeing is owners and people are just writing a check and writing it off as the cost of doing business, where somebody's going to get hurt and is going to get seriously hurt or killed. And I think that's why you're starting to see a lot of the conferences starting to put some kind of penalty towards it, not just, monetary fines, but they're talking about now maybe even forfeiture of home games against that rival in the future.
Points deductions. So we're coming up to the end of the football season here. The soccer season will finish in mid-May. And anybody who's got the last game of the season, we are required to present to the Premier League a risk assessment of what you're going to do and how you're going to, one, in the first instance, prevent it, two, what you're going to do, react in if it happens, And then, I mean, last year, Manchester City got fined on the last game of the season, £330,000, about $660,000, as well as then points deductions coming into the next season. And that's where it hurts the owners of the clubs, because money for some of the owners is not the issue. It's actually where they sit, the brand protection of being a credible club and so forth. So, points deductions are also applied here.
You know, it's almost impossible if you've got 80,000 people, like we saw at a football game, encroach onto the field. I mean, you're not going to stop them. But to Eileen's point, you've got to have that plan. What are your priorities? You know, our plan for us is we're protecting, certain assets and people. And that's our number one thing, and making sure we try to keep everybody safe, because we can't stop, 30, 40,000 people from coming over a wall.
I do think an education campaign helps. It's not the solve. But, what we were doing for every quarter was putting messages up about behavior and about respect and about expectations of fan involvement and fan code of conduct and things of those nature. I think the more and more you could put that in your game plan, your video boards, your messaging, your PA announcements, things of that. It's not sexy. It's not enjoyable. It's not fun, but it is important. And I think that if you can get that into your entertainment script, the better off you are. That also goes to show that you did have intent to try not to make this happen when something goes wrong in the future.
But Jim, I think Joe touched on this by talking about schools writing checks. We have to do a much better job, and Amy touched on this. A lot of this stuff is alcohol related, and we have to do a much, much better job of monitoring alcohol sales, monitoring that guest, and then really trying to address the situation before we have a situation. We've been really, really good with court security. I know, Amy, you folks do a great job at Chase. You got a wonderful reputation. We've been very lucky in Detroit. But I think a lot of that is because of the police training and the consistency of the officers that are assigned to the court. But you see some of the things at University of Michigan Stadium, and I'm a season ticket holder. To Joe's point, you got 100,000 people running out onto the football stadium. It's nothing but somebody getting hurt. Yep. Somebody's going to get hurt going over that wall.
Listen, this has been a really lively discussion. We're coming on to the end of our hour here. Does anybody have any final thoughts very quickly that they would like to present, kind of wrap this up?
I think the doctor does.
Well, Dr. Liu, we've had quite a discussion here. I mean, we could probably go on for 2 hours with all the topics, but we can see that we have challenges going forward. But I think the solution to those challenges is that we keep talking, we keep discussing, and sharing successful practices among ourselves. So, Lou, back to you, sir. And I want to thank the panelists.
Well, Gary, first of all, thank you for the great insight that the experts brought to the country here. And the panelists, thank you again for giving us that knowledge and really gave us some ideas for the future and set the stage for the difference that we've had in policing and what we can do to enhance those capabilities down the road. So thank you so much. Thank you, the attendees, too, for coming. And it's been a wonderful hour. Thank you one more time. All right. And I just want to remind everybody, and it came up so much today at this town hall about this integration of us as security directors and safety directors to work closely with the guest services people, the premium people, the food and beverage, the hospitality, parking. This is a conference that's new in America here, where we can bring everybody together under one roof and discuss all these issues as we have today. But always remembering that safety and security is the base of a good experience for the fan. So, folks, thank you so much, and have a rest of a great day.